Morning. I think we got all the technology actually working again, so I guess that's good. Second to the last lecture presentation in this segment. We have, if I can keep from choking my way through it, today's presentation on population and communities, Tuesday's presentation on social change, then a study day on Thursday, and then the very last day of class, which will be a week from Tuesday, I will hold a review. So this day and Tuesday are the only 2 days where it will be possible to get Rick Perry points. The last two class periods are voluntary, in a sense. I mean, a study day. You can come in here and study if you want, but no one will be here. And then the review for the final exam is just up to you. I'll come in here and do the review as Christine has done throughout the term. So any questions about that? Just roll through this stuff. Final exam is Friday of finals week at 7:30 in the morning, right? And in order to get the grade, in order to move up a grade, you need to beat your lowest test score by the number of points it would take you to get to the next grade. So if you have 238 and your lowest test score is 40, you need to get a 45 on the final to move up, right? All that's perfectly clear? Man, I'm good at this. All right. Population and community. A couple of things we study because we are part of populations and we live in communities. Population scholars, demographers, we call them, for demography is the term we use to describe the study of population, demography. What demographers study are fertility rates. How many people are born per capita in a given population. Fertility depends, and you're going to want to call Stockholm on this, I'm serious. Fertility depends completely, that's either my phone or it's a siren. That's my phone, actually. I thought I silenced it. It's my brother-in-law. Seriously. No, it's on silent, trust me. And I don't know how that came through. My brother-in-law is a retired homicide cop, so that's his ringtone. Anyway, where was I? Anybody have any idea what I was talking about? Fertility, maybe? Okay. Yeah, I was about to have you call Stockholm. Fertility, this is going to sound great on the tape, isn't it? I don't think anybody listens to these anyway. If anybody's listening to this, thank you for that. Fertility depends completely on the percentage of the population of in any country or population group. It depends on the percentage of those in that population that are women of childbearing age. See? I told you you're going to call Stockholm on this. Countries with higher percentages of their populations who are female between the ages of about 15 and 50 have higher fertility rates. Now comes the important point. What types of countries have higher fertility rates? Rich countries or poor countries? Remember, fertility depends on the percentage of the population who are females of childbearing age. Poor countries, because they will have fewer relative numbers of people that are elderly, for one thing, because life expectancy is shorter. So fertility rates are higher in poorer countries. So also are mortality and infant mortality rates. But overall, population growth is higher in poorer countries, which suggests that it's a problem in the places where the government and infrastructure are least well equipped to handle it. Yeah?
Infant mortality only goes up to what age?
It's measured in terms of the percentage of live births that result in a death before the first birthday, 1 year. I'll get to that in a second, I think. Fertility rates in the U.S. are moderate, and they're nearly balanced off by mortality rates. Mortality rates are the incidence of death in a population. Demographers who are specialists in epidemiology, which is the study of distribution of disease, we've talked about that, pay attention to causes of death. What is it that produces mortality in countries? And, of course, in poorer countries, mortality is produced by famine or war or genocide. And in wealthier countries, it's produced by diseases or old age or all manners of things. Infant mortality is the rate at which infants born alive don't make it to their first birthday. It's generally measured in terms of the number of infants per 1,000. So it's not quite a percentage. It's like a factor of 10 off of a percentage. And in the U.S., our infant mortality rate is somewhere between 6 and 7, which is sort of middling, 6 or 7 out of 1,000, sort of middling in Western societies or developed countries, if you will. But as I've said before, and I just want to make sure you remember at least this much from this class, I think that the country's infant mortality rate is its leading indicator of quality of life. And in my opinion, the disparity in infant mortality in the U.S. between Anglo and ethnic babies is a pro-life issue. I think we ought to deal with that in some way, since the disparity is about fourfold. And it has everything to do with decisions we've made about the healthcare system. Finally, migration is a measure of the relative numbers of people who move to or move out of countries. We usually refer to it as in-migration or out-migration. And people who study this test, define, and measure what are called pull and push factors. Pull and push factors. There are characteristics about some countries that pull people to them. There are characteristics about other types of countries where people are pushed from them, sometimes secretly, sometimes forcefully. So is the United States a country where you would expect a lot of in-migration or out-migration? Clearly. From push factors or pull factors? Probably pull factors, although both are at work. The substantial number of immigrants, especially coming from Mexico, to find jobs that don't pay much, relatively speaking, in the U.S., but from which they can actually send money back to families in Mexico and improve their lives pretty dramatically, that's a strong pull. And the fact that it's hard to do this suggests how strong that pull is. It is not easy to come into the U.S. legally, and it's even harder to come into the U.S. illegally, and yet people do it pretty much in droves. Now, population growth is a kind of arithmetic assessment of these three factors: fertility, mortality, and migration. The U.S. has a relatively steady but moderate rate of population growth. 20 years ago, the U.S. population was about 250 million. Now it's about 300 million. So it's grown by about 20%. Largely through the effects of migration. Fertility and mortality almost cancel each other out. Not completely. The fertility rates are a little bit higher than the mortality rates in the U.S. But largely through the effects of migration, the U.S. population has a slow, steady growth rate of, let's just ballpark it at 1 or 2% a year. What does that do for quality of life? Well, let me first off ask if there are any questions about any of those four terms. Say anything more about them? Repeat a definition, anything like that? Yeah?
You do mortality again?
It's the incidence, it's a measure of the incidence of death in a population. And sometimes people who study this stuff who specialize in epidemiology, which is it's a branch of demography, look at the causes of death. You know, why, not just how much death occurs, but why does it occur? And heart disease is the leading, heart disease and cancer are the two leading causes of death in the U.S. Else, anything else? Okay. Quality of life is measured by an assessment of how intense the level of poverty is in a country, how available is a supply of food, and natural resources. What's interesting to me is that we define poverty much differently in the U.S. than we do worldwide. Poverty in the U.S. refers to, you know, it refers to low income, the poverty line for a family of four, the income level for a family of four that's defined as anything below this is regarded as poverty, is about $23,000, $24,000 a year, which in many countries across the world would be not just a small, but a substantial fortune. Poverty in the U.S. is defined as low income, substandard housing, and poor nutrition. Worldwide, we define poverty, we don't even talk about income for a lot of folks who live in underdeveloped countries. It's defined in terms of starvation and homelessness. I have said this a couple of different times and in a couple of different contexts, but every single college student in a U.S. university has, in a sense, hit the lottery with regard to life circumstances and life chances, because there are hundreds of millions of people your age living in places that you don't want to go near, that essentially have no shot at a materially comfortable, upwardly mobile, full life, to life expectancy for human beings, as it were. So I regard that as a blessing. And I don't necessarily mean that in a religious way. I regard it as just good luck that gives me a level of responsibility to make good use of this opportunity. So I guess that does sound preachy, so take it for that. Now you don't have to go to church on Sunday. There was the sermon. Food supply is a political issue. If a person, I don't know if you'd call it a person, if a Martian sociologist was looking at planet Earth using all of the tools you would expect invisible Martian sociologists would have, they would notice, first of all, that the Earth has X number of people. They could count us, all right? They would probably know or could research what the nutritional needs of a human being are. What does a human being need to stay alive nutritionally? And then they could probably measure the availability of those nutritional products on planet Earth. Meat, grain, water, other things. The things that are essential to life. And if they looked at the amount of available food, and they knew the nutritional needs of a human being, and they also knew how many people were on planet Earth, and they ran a simple calculation, they would learn that there is enough food on planet Earth to feed everybody. Plenty, as it turns out. Plenty of food, plenty of nutritional resources on planet Earth to feed every human being on it. So then the interesting question becomes to real sociologists, why are people starving? Why do some people starve? The politics of food distribution. Maybe it's a little bit too strong to say it this way, but I want to make the point. There are, again, places on planet Earth where you don't want to be an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old, where some people living in that country eat very well. The military, those in charge of the government, or maybe the one or two or three people most in charge of the government. These are also countries into which a great deal of nutritional aid and support comes from places like the United States and the International Red Cross. And that food is distributed by the people who eat well, the military and the dictators, or the oligarchs, if you want to call it that. And they distribute it in ways that are corrupt. They may even sell it to even poorer countries. But they will prevent the populace from getting enough food, and this is maybe a little bit of an overstatement, but not by much. They will prevent the general populace from getting enough food to have enough strength to kick them out of office. In other words, to rebel and overthrow the military. You've got to be strong to do that. One way to keep people from getting strong enough to kick you out is to starve them. And that's how it happens. The politics of food distribution. The politics of distribution of even food that is provided by developed countries in good faith. And everybody knows this. We have diplomatic relations with some countries who do this. In part because of the last issue, natural resources. Natural resources are scarce, and we compete for them. And that is the definition anthropologically of war. Competition for scarce resources. I think, accurately referred to as warfare. And we are competing for scarce resources in the Middle East and have been part of a warfare initiative for some time to try to establish a more just and democratic political process in countries where that's resisted by the leadership and in some instances resisted by the people for reasons related to what they think is self-interest or maybe even religious reasons. But I think it's interesting to note that the resource, the scarce resource over which there is, I think, at the moment the most competition is oil. And here are two things that a lot of people don't know. Maybe, and I suppose it's possible that I've already told you this so everybody does know, because I talk about this stuff sort of randomly all the time. We import oil from several places. We import most of our oil from two places. Do you know where those, what those countries are? Canada's number one. What's number two? Sort of like Canada, but just south? Mexico, yeah. Everybody know, how many of you did not know that? That the two sources of our imported oil are primarily Canada and Mexico. Anybody not know that? Well, now you know. Everybody knows it now. I think that's interesting. We'll take your oil, but you keep your people out. You know, unless they want to build roads, pick tomatoes, or kill pigs, then they're okay. And here's the thing that I just learned fairly recently, within the last couple of years. We also export oil. Places, you know, companies like ExxonMobil and Shell and others, we export oil to other countries. Did you know that we actually export, we send out of our country for pay, more oil than we import? Did you know that? If we stopped exporting, if we stopped importing oil completely from everywhere and just kept the oil that we're producing on our own property, if you will, we'd have more oil. Who knew that? Who's a little bit surprised by that? Just a little bit surprised. Politics and economics. Three little sound bites, three little pieces of broccoli from the salad bar on population and quality of life, elements of demography. Questions? That's it? Okay. Let's talk about communities then. These are smaller versions of populations. There actually is a technical definition for community that is sort of illustrative in a way. Let me give it to you. It's a relatively self-contained social unit, a relatively self-contained social unit. That sounds like it comes out of a textbook, doesn't it? Why don't these people write in English? I'll translate it in a minute. A relatively self-contained social unit whose members share territory, a common identity, and a sense of belonging. Bunch of people that live in the same place, call themselves collectively by a particular name, and have that be a part of their collective identity. A dorm floor would do it. What's the name of a dorm on campus? I can't think of one.
Weymouth.
Five. Does it have five floors? Okay. Weymouth 5 would be a community. What do I? I've never been in a dormitory. How do I know? A fraternity or sorority house where people live would be a kind of community. When I was a graduate student, I lived in a 6-flat walk-up brownstone apartment in the city of Chicago. And we had stairwell parties. We were a stairwell. We even gave ourselves a name. And I don't remember what the name was, but it had something to do with St. Patrick's Day, because our St. Patrick's Day parties in the stairwell were legendary. I said grad school. I meant seminary. That's when I was studying to be a minister. Legendary stairwell parties on St. Patrick's Day. Heck, we were Lutherans. Everybody drinks in Lutheranism. Anyway. Community is largely what you make of it. Now, large cities are populations, but there are broken down into large cities neighborhoods that fit the definition of community. In the city of Chicago, for example, we lived in a community called Hyde Park, and it was related to, one of the parks in the geographical area. But it was known as an independent ward. Our alderman, our city council representative, was not a member of the Chicago, at that time, Democratic political machine. And so when it snowed, we were the last unit, we were the last neighborhood, we were the last precinct to be plowed. I literally had to take my car that was parked in an off-street parking lot, jack it up and put chains on the car, on the tires, drive it about 4 blocks to get it out of that neighborhood, pull over in a bus stop, undo the chains, and then I could drive. Eh, you guys got it so easy, I tell you what. You're lucky that you moved to a place where it doesn't snow as much. Neighborhoods are defined ethnically and they're defined politically. In New York, there is a very well-defined neighborhood called Little Italy. In Chicago and other places, Chinatown. And other neighborhoods that are defined ethnically that are a little bit sort of odd and ironic. One of the neighborhoods in Chicago where I worked, I had a field education job in a church in an area of Chicago that was known then and is still known on most tourist maps as Andersonville. Andersonville. It's on the near north side of the city. Anybody have any idea what the ethnic background of at least those who first formed a community there? Andersonville? The Anderson family? Where would they likely be from? Sweden? Yeah. Swedish Covenant Hospital is up there. It's a great little restaurant around the corner from the church where after we were done working, we could go get Swedish pancakes and lingonberries. And if you've never had a lingonberry, well, try it sometime. Anyway, now that neighborhood is still known as Andersonville, but is almost completely now inhabited by another group of immigrants from Laos, Cambodia, and Vietnam. So the Swedish restaurant's gone, but you can get some killer stir fry right around the corner. It's just great in some ways. But you get the idea. In a large city, people seek to find a kind of smaller identity. We're not just Chicagoans or New Yorkers. We live in Manhattan or Staten Island or the Bronx or the South Bronx, as it were. But a community can be characterized by simply a bunch of people that share that common territory. And it could be a dorm floor or a frat house or something like that, or just an apartment that that a dozen people live in, as it were. Gentrification is a process by which poorer neighborhoods, low-income neighborhoods, are resettled by prosperous business and family entities. They're resettled by rich people, largely for purposes of making money. The area immediately east of the campus, several square miles, 15 years ago, was much different than it is now. It was very low income, rent houses, pretty scummy apartments, a lot of vacant lots. And the McDougal Corporation in town bought pretty much all of that land and all of the property at a substantial amount of money, but not as much as they wound up making from it. They were able to spend, they had a lot of money to begin with, so they spent the money to buy the property and homes, tear them down, and rebuild what you see today. Upscale apartments, condos, restaurants, 17 Starbucks, I think. And it's called gentrification. Now, the upside of gentrification is pretty profound. The value of that property has gone way up. And the taxes paid to the city on the value of that property has gone way up. The big question is, though, on the downside, what happened to all those people? Well, they were scattered and fragmented. Many of them became homeless. Homelessness is a much more profound population. Homelessness is a much more profound problem in the U.S. than it is in almost any other developed country. Now, we're a lot more complex and have a lot more diversity, and that's part of it. But we have perfected the art of gentrification to great positive effect, most would argue. Downtown Denver, one of the first large-scale gentrification efforts, and it's a wonderful place. You know, they put the put Coors Field down there, so the Colorado Rockies play right downtown. So also in Houston, The Rockies play a little better than the Astros, I think. I'm not sure. Might be a push this year. I don't know. Anyway, restaurants, condos, hotels, conference centers, all this great stuff. But the question is, where'd the people go? A lot, because they get, you know, when a corporation comes in and essentially goes door to door and says, we will buy your house, or more accurately, goes to landlords and say, we'll buy your property, they typically pay them a partial premium on the cost of that. And then the landlords go and say to the people who live there, lease schmies, you've got 2 months to leave. And by the way, here's $1,000 or something to that effect. They go, sweet, I'll take the $1,000, but that doesn't go very far. And the next thing you know, they're looking for a place to live and have no resources to secure it. The area immediately south of what was known as North Overton, across 19th Street, south of Lubbock High School, has undergone a fairly dramatic change in the last 10, 15 years. The area has become much more transient. People are moving in and out of there much more quickly. The stability of the population is kind of rocky. It's an area where my wife works as an after-school volunteer in a church-based literacy and tutoring program. We see kids, first and second graders, but it goes first through fifth. And even in that program, you know, the kids, there's an element of revolving door there, you know, where the kid is suddenly not there and the director of the program said, oh, they moved, they got evicted, the dad went to prison, the mother left, etc. And the crime rate is a little bit higher. There are more homeless in the area that have now drifted even further east into what's now known in Lubbock as Tent City. We didn't have Tent City before. We had McDougalville, as it were. That's what I call the area just east of the campus. And I have no massive problem with it. I think the upside is essentially a relatively good thing, as long as at least it's acknowledged that it solved some problems, but it did in fact create others. And there seems to be a lessened level of interest in fixing the problems it caused than what was initially a solution to a different set of problems, if that makes sense. And there's a piece for reading on this that illustrates this. There are two essays that were written about the time the area east of the campus was being resettled and finalized. Basically, I titled them Overton 1 and Overton 2, and they're local editorials that detail the up and down side of that. Somebody playing Candy Crush Saga? I can't yell at you because my phone went off. Urban ecology is the study of the interrelationships in cities and how city management, how city infrastructure influences population. Got a very interesting sociology lesson when I was a young intern pastor in a town just southwest of Chicago, Joliet, Illinois. It's not a suburb, it's a fairly substantial city, a couple hundred thousand. And it's sort of out on the, at least at the time, on the outskirts of the Chicago Metroplex. And a pharmacist friend of mine was a member of my church, and he and I were having coffee one time, and he said, you know, the best thing we can, we were talking about East Joliet and West Joliet and how different they were, kind of like East and West Lubbock in some sense. And he said, the best thing we could do for race relations in the city of Joliet is to fill up the river with cement. Because the river was kind of an ecological boundary. And if you lived on one side of the river, you had better schools, that's where the mall was, etc., etc. The hospital on the west side was a much nicer hospital than the east side, and so on. Because the river was a natural dividing line. We have built a dividing line that has a similar effect in Lubbock. It's called Interstate 27. And I don't know who knew what bodies were buried where, but Lubbock and Amarillo have their own interstate, and almost nobody else uses it. I don't know what that's about. But I do know that East and West Lubbock is divided by cement. So maybe the cement idea on the river wasn't such a great idea if they made it a highway. I guess if they made it a skate park, that would be different. But it didn't take me long when I moved here to realize that there was almost nothing I needed to run my life that forced me to go across to the east side of town. A friend of mine and I were teaching summer school at the time together. made it our business to go find lunch spots on the east side of town. We found a killer barbecue joint and a Mexican place that is still there, I believe, called Rosita's on 35th and Avenue A, which is run by, well, if it's not still run by Rosita, it's run by her family, and it's just a wonderful place. But you got to really look to find it. I did wind up at the Patterson Library one time. Did I tell you this story? When I went to the Patterson Library, it happened to be on Election Day in 2008. Did I mention this? Patterson Library is on the east side of town. The only reason I went there is because the website told me that the latest Jonathan Kellerman thriller was available at the Patterson Library, but not at Goedeke Library, which is on my side of town. Right? That's where I go. So I trundled my little self over to the Patterson Library, forgetting that it, not forgetting it was Election Day, but forgetting that libraries are sometimes polling places. And so I pulled into the parking lot. I was surprised there were so many cars there because the Patterson Library, it's a nice little library, but not too many people go there. But it was full. Well, they were there to vote. So I went in and got my book, came out. And as I was coming out of the Patterson Library on Election Day in 2008, that's important, there was a young, about 30-ish maybe, African-American woman with a woman who appeared to all the world to be her grandmother. She was 80-plus if she was a day. And the young woman was taking a picture of the older African-American woman next to the sign that said, "Vote Here." And suddenly I realized what this was about. This is a woman who has lived 80-plus years as an African-American in the South and just got to vote for a black guy for president. And it was a thrilling experience for them. So I said, "Would you like me to take both of your pictures? You know, give me the camera, I'll take your pic." Wow, how cool is that? So I take their picture and I hand the camera back and they're both crying, you know. I thought, oh, I get now, East and West Lubbock, here we go. I voted on that day too and I didn't cry on my way out. But I welled up a little bit on my way home in my car after having witnessed that little vignette. You get the idea? Urban ecology. I was living in Chicago. I went to a Chicago White Sox game, which is in, at the time, it was in a really dreadful part of town. It was right across the interstate from almost mile after mile of high-rise public housing, which were war zones. They've since been torn down. That was a failed experiment at racial segregation in Chicago. And the White Sox ballpark sits right across the street from there. And a couple of blocks west of the ballpark was a set of railroad tracks and a viaduct. And that's where the free parking was, which you could park on the street. So I put my little Ford Pinto, the one that didn't explode, on the other side of the viaduct. I'm coming across, I'm coming underneath the railroad tracks, and there's a police officer there. And he looks at me, and he sees a 20-something white guy. And he said, you know, it's 6:30, 7 o'clock, you know, it's light outside and so on. He said, "Go get your car, bring it to this side of the viaduct. Or when the game is over, somebody's going to kill you." Something to that effect. I don't think he used those words, but that was his point. That viaduct, just two blocks west of Comiskey Park, White Sox Park. I think it's called U.S. Cellular Field now. Whatever. Was an urban ecological landmark. And if you were a young white guy, and it was suddenly 10:30 at night, you had no business on the other side of that viaduct. Same kind of thing. We went to New Orleans, my wife and I, the day we got married, and that night we went to New Orleans, checked into a hotel in the French Quarter. It was a wonderful place. And we come out of the hotel, and we're dealing with the valet and getting the car parked, and the valet guy takes me aside. He says, "No need for you to go five blocks that way or eight blocks that way. Don't bother, the river was this way." He said, "Don't go across canal. Stay here." In New Orleans, the French Quarter is a wonderful place to go and be a tourist because the city of New Orleans knows that that's a great source of revenue. And it, in fact, is a great source of revenue. One night in a hotel and a dinner at a really nice restaurant will set you back. If it happens to be your wedding day, it's worth it. But within a mile of that wonderful place and those wonderful experiences, again, are war zones. Stay the heck out of there, or someone will kill you. Lots and lots and lots of undercover police officers working the tourist crowd in the French Quarter. Much fewer working the housing project just on the other side of the interstate. Get the idea? urban ecology. Which brings about perspectives on city life. These are different than theoretical perspectives. This is what it's like to live in a big city. Let me just ask, how many of you call home one of the major cities in Texas? The Dallas Metroplex, somewhere around there, San Antonio, Houston, Austin. Okay. How many come from small towns? I've got a thing on the, you don't see it, but written in white ink, right about here, is small towns. I got a short riff on small towns, and I'm sailing through this lecture today, so we'll have enough time to talk about that. As is true in most instances, your overall perspective on your life can be summed up by this little truism. Where you stand, in other words, how you feel, where you stand depends on where you sit. Which side of the river do you live on? Which side of the viaduct? Are you in that neighborhood before or after it was gentrified? Where you stand depends on where you sit. The city is a lonely crowd. This is the perspective of those who I think sort of live between wealth and poverty, who are moving their way toward material comfort. These are the folks who maybe... Oh, small town folks, raise your hand again. Give me the name of a couple of small towns where you're from. Just shout them out.
Munster.
Stratford. Clifton. Okay. I didn't understand.
Stratford.
Oh, Jafford.
Stratford.
Yes. Don't you love hearing loss? There are people who come from your towns that are at Texas Tech University studying to get degrees in business or some such thing. And the object of the game is to get a good job in the Metroplex somewhere. Who would say that's not uncommon? I want to go to the Metroplex and, you know, get a good job and so on. That your experience, at least initially, will be that you are in and around countless thousands of people. And you will feel all alone. Unless you're with somebody who loves you very much and you can feel at least a couple. In that sense, city's a lonely crowd. How do you work your way into relationships? Well, one way to do it is to start a family and then your kids go to school. But it takes a while. It takes a while to get that done. For some, moving to the city is a place they go after a relationship has ended and trying to restart connections. You know, we talked about Durkheim early in the term. You know, how connected are people to their culture, their society? Well, if the city is a lonely crowd, and you're kind of just getting your life either up and running or restarting in some ways, it takes a while to turn your perspective on the city as being all alone in a place where there are thousands of people to an urban village, which is why people move to cities, because they are, in fact, by and large, wonderful places. I have favorite restaurants in Austin, Dallas, San Antonio, and Houston. And every time I go there, I save up a little money and make sure I get a chance to experience things that I can't find in the same way in Lubbock. I like professional sporting events. And as great as it is to live in a town, if you're a sports fan, that has, you know, Big 12 athletics, it's still fun to go see an NBA game, or a Major League Baseball game, and so on, hockey. And you have to do that to get to, in order to do that, you have to get to the city. Now, that requires a level of upward mobility in some means, you know. Sports Illustrated did a piece not long ago about the most expensive place to watch a professional sporting event. And in America, the most expensive place to watch a professional sporting event is at AT&T Stadium in Arlington, Texas, watching a Cowboys game. With the tickets, the parking, the food, etc. They win. I don't know who loses. Well, I guess I don't know. etc. So the city is an urban village, but it requires some means to become a villager. Now, you know... having said that, and I truly do love big cities. I lived in the city of Chicago at a time when I was getting my life together. Now, as a grad student, we had some advantages. We'd get dirt cheap Chicago Symphony tickets, and it was wonderful. But if I had stayed there and tried to start my life there, I would have started out as a member of a lonely crowd and would have had to work some years to build it up. I think Lubbock, for me anyway, splits the difference and splits it in a way that I think is beneficial to what I want to do and how I want to live in lots of interesting ways. I tell people that in Lubbock you can do 90% of what you can do anywhere in Texas or even in America in terms of city, entertainment, food. You can do 90% of what you can do anywhere with about 10% of the hassle. And the hassle factor is what it requires money to overcome in large cities. As a special event in my wife and my life, we went to London and spent a week enjoying what you can enjoy in London for about 2 years worth of savings of extra money. And one of the things that we did in London was go to a stage play. London Theater is arguably the finest theater in the world. And so we went to this wonderful, we saw Wicked, which you should see, it was terrific. Anyway, so I was talking to the hotel concierge guy, and I said, you know, because we could take a cab to the theater, that wasn't any problem. And I said, okay, how easy is it to get a cab? And the theater wasn't even that far away, you know, 2 miles tops. How easy is it to get a cab from the theater on the way back? And he said, well, think of it this way. There are 2,500 people trying to do exactly the same thing at exactly the same time. I said, what would you suggest? He said, I would suggest hiring a car. I had never hired a car in my life. He told me how much that was, and I swallowed a minute and said, I've never spent that much on anything like that ever. And yet I thought to myself, you're only here once. My wife certainly, and me even a little bit, if we don't get the cab thing done exactly right, it's going to be frightening. Because it's a big city we have no clue about. So I went, okay, and did a little calculation in my head, and I said, okay, get us a car. And it was one of the most intriguing moments of my life because, first of all, the car took us there, and the guy that drove it, who was an immigrant, said, I will meet you right here when the play is over. I said, well, how do you know when the play? I know when these things are over. That's his job. So we come out of the theater. There's this crush of people hailing cabs, and about 15 yards away from the door is our guy with his hat in his hand waving to us. Thought, you know what? I love London. This is great. I can live like this for the next 2 days. Do you get the idea? There are people who live like that all the time. They love the city. Right? It was an interesting experience. And a good learning one, you know. Because it also put my own life in perspective. You know what? We had a wonderful time. I'll never forget it, but I'm okay living where I live. 250,000, big enough. I truly didn't think my life would be complete until I moved back to the city of Chicago, because I loved it the couple of years that I was able to make it work. Actually, as a grad student, you really can live more cheaply than other people your age, because you have benefits of lower housing and all that. Now, I'm happy where I am. So, you know, I guess I'm waxing philosophical today because the clock is, I'm getting done here a lot quicker than I thought I would. When you're trying to decide, this is your Dutch Uncle Jerry talking again. When you're trying to decide what to do with your life, you can ask yourself this question, you know, how much money can I make? Not an unreasonable question to ask, but I think the more important question to ask is how do you want to live? How do you want to live? You want to live with a car at your beck and call and a guy to drive it? Great. Figure out how to get that done and go do it. You want to live, you know, happy in the company of others? Figure out how to do that. You want to live where you have a job that pays you to do what you already like? That would be the best of all worlds, right? Decide what you already like doing. See if you can find somebody to pay you to do that and live in a way that both makes sense, gives you comfort and happiness. That's why 3 times I've declined the opportunity to become an administrator around here. I'm talking to my wife about it, and I said, I I'm glad they asked. It was interesting. But I would wind up in a job where instead of spending 10% of my time doing things I despise, which is about true now, I would have to spend 90% of my time doing things I despise. And I don't want to live that way. I know how old I am. I know what life expectancy is. I know how much longer I'd have to work. Why would I want to squander probably 30% of the rest of my life doing something I hate? Sorry. I'll stay with this. But that's the issue. And you might have to slog through a lonely crowd period to get to where you live in your own urban, suburban, rural village. A lot of folks in here, I suspect, would not want to live anywhere near a big city. I want 20 acres so I don't have to lease my hunting time or some such thing. I don't know. Find out how you want to live. That's the question you need to ask. What kind of life do I want? Because I will tell you, folks, I was 25 years old 6 months ago, at least in my head. I'm serious. I am dead serious about that. The city is an arena of conflict. Lots and lots and lots of people fight to get through every day. They fight for a place on the bus. They fight for the money for bus fare. They fight for a seat on the bus. I'm being metaphorical now. They fight to get through what they're asked or required to do in a job that they really don't much like, but it's the job that pays them what they get paid, which may not be enough. There are people who actually own small businesses in cities that fight. Let's imagine you own a donut shop on one corner of a block in the city of Chicago. You got your own donut shop, Jim's Donuts, right? And they put a Starbucks on the other end of the block. And then the city decides that particular block needs a bus stop. And you go and petition the city for the bus stop to be in front of your donut shop, which would be great, wouldn't it? Imagine, it's a cold winter Chicago day. There are 15 people waiting for the bus on your street in front of your donut shop. And they're going, donuts. Where do you suppose that bus stop's going to wind up? Down the street. You're going to lose the fight. And at that point, maybe, you're going to lose your donut shop. I don't know. You get the idea? Another instance where my wife and I spent a weekend in a place that was affordable to us for the weekend was in New York. Did I tell you about Omelet Maker Guy ever? We stayed in a hotel in Central Park South. And we got the weekend deal, which I think was $250 a night for the weekend deal. And we looked at the thing on the back of the door. That room normally, if you wanted to play full sticker price, was like $650 a night, which we couldn't come close to. But it came with free breakfast. Oh, yay. And we went down, and there was a guy making omelets, killer omelets. It was great. I mean, we had all manners of things. Diced ham, jalapenos, onions, anything you want on an omelet. And he didn't speak any English. I'm guessing from his name tag that he was maybe Nigerian or some such place, right? Big smile, happy to help. You had to point to what you wanted. Oh, 5 minutes later, killer omelet. Free! I was wondering where Omelet Maker Guy lived to get to this hotel in Central Park South by 5:30 in the morning to start making omelets for, from his point of view, wealthy, snotty white people like me. I tried to be nice. Put something in the tip jar. I'm guessing he got up about 4, took at least one train and maybe 2 bus rides to get to where he worked. And maybe by now, I hope, he's got his own omelet restaurant. I don't know. Hope it's not down the street from a Starbucks where the bus stop is. You get the idea? The city is an arena of conflict. Just to do simple, stupid things like going to get your car registration renewed in the city of Chicago was a hassle. Now I suppose you can do it online. So I guess that is true if you have hot Wi-Fi and internet access. I don't know. Where you stand on city life largely depends on where you sit. And now, unless there are any questions, any term you want me to define or say again? An urban village is a place, is an experience of city life that really requires some level of wealth and means. And you can accumulate that through initiative and education. You can also accumulate that if that's the house in which you grew up, as it were. And be grateful. Be grateful. Anything else? A tip of the old bald spot to small town life. I do not want to live in a small town, but I have had the experience of being the minister of the only church in the smallest town I think exists, at least in West Central Illinois. A little town called Fountain Green, Illinois, which is about 10 miles from town, a town called Blandonsville, and about 20 miles from the big town, which is Macomb, a town of about 15,000. Fountain Green, Illinois, population 89. Maybe more, maybe less now, I don't know. Two commercial industries or businesses in that town. My church at the time, the First Presbyterian Church of Fountain Green, Illinois. It still exists. You could look it up. And Jerry's Auto Salvage, which was right across the street. No more post office, no more grocery store, no more bank. There were buildings where the post office, bank, and grocery store used to be. But you get the idea, right? About 10 square blocks of small houses, trailers, and so on. A couple of blocks worth of, you know, 3-4-bedroom ranch style, but one empty school. Jerry's Auto Salvage was also the town restaurant because he had a candy machine and a coffee pot and a wood stove in the middle. Now, West Central Illinois in the winter can get cold. Well, I was the minister of the Presbyterian Church right across the street, and a couple of days a week, I would go and visit some of the people. This is when I was in grad school. I would go visit some of the people, some of the mostly elderly, because they were all but about 10 elderly in the church. Sunday worship had about 25 on a good day, right? So my routine was to drive 20 miles from the city where I lived, the city, 15,000, to Fountain Green, park out in front of Jerry's Auto Salvage, come in and get a cup of, dreadful coffee, horrible coffee. But it was the restaurant, right? Sit down, put my feet up, you know, close to the wood stove, and tell lies with the other guys for a while. It was just, you know, get a cup of coffee. Well, one very cold January morning, I mean, the air temperature was about 10 below, bright sunny day, snow all over the place, I limped my little car out there. I'd traded the Pinto a long time ago. Now I had a Geo Metro. Limped that thing out there, had a cup of coffee. In walks Joe Spangler. That's his real name. Joe Spangler is about 60 and comes in and said, "Hey, preacher, how you doing?" You know, we tell a couple of jokes. And he says, "You got to go see Mom today." I says, "She all right?" "Oh, yeah, she's great." Mamie, his mom, is 90 years old. And she lives in the country. She lives in the farmhouse that's been in her family for probably 150 years. "Got to go see Mom today." I said, "What's up?" She goes, "Mom made apple pie." I said, "I'm on it." That is one of the best parts about being a small town preacher is coffee and apple pie or something to that effect when you go visiting people, right? I am on it. Finish the coffee. Mamie's house is in the middle of literally nowhere. It's in the forgotten part of Forgottonia. And you walk in, and first of all, when you pull into the driveway, you can smell, because not only is there a wood stove in Jerry's Auto Salvage, that Mamie baked that pie in a wood-fired oven, because that's the only oven they've ever had in that house, right? You can smell the wood stove. You come in, you're just assaulted by these aromas of really wonderful things. I'm going, "Man, this is a good day today. It's 10 below, but the sun's out and Mamie made apple pie." I am not making this story up in any sense. I'm not embellishing this story a lick. This is how it happened. So I go in and I swear to you, the warmest place in Hancock County, Illinois on that January day was Mamie Spangler's kitchen. I will also tell you that probably the coldest indoor place in Hancock County, Illinois, on that particular day at that moment, was the upstairs bedroom in the same house. Because the furnace was wood-fired, etc. It was a throwback. I felt like I needed to take school notes on a shovel with charcoal, you know. But I will never forget it. And Mamie, of course, is, I mean, this was 30 years ago, no, 25 plus years ago. Mamie is long since, you know, making apple pie in a much better place for much cooler people. But you get the idea. I mean, small towns have that kind of experience that you literally can't get. I mean, Starbucks cannot reproduce that. They will sell you apple pie and coffee, but it ain't the same, right? And I'm not saying I wanted to live there. I did not. Because, you know, if you're the preacher in a small town, that can be a mixed blessing as well. Not that church, but the next one. I got taken aside and said, you know, some of the people think that convertible you drive is inappropriate for a minister. And I'm going, well, I'm the only minister you're going to get, and I'm going to, you know, I'm be done with grad school in 2 years, so live with it. But, you know, that kind of thing. Everybody knows your business. You know, that can be helpful if you get support from that. On the other hand, your business is, I mean, it's less secure than email in a small town, right? Am I right about that? Something happens to you, and you're rehearsing how you're, I mean, you're a kid in a small town, and you're rehearsing how you're going to explain this, how you're going to create perceptions in your parents' eyes that make you look like at least a decent human being. And by the time you get home, they know the whole story better than you do, and forget about it. You can't change perception. You're going, yeah, that happened. You get it. Population and community. Questions? Comments? That's all I got. One more shot on Tuesday. Have a nice weekend. Thank you.